Welcome to Studio Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. My guest today is a leading world expert on climate and sustainability, Dr. Kimberly Nicholas, who grew up on her family's vineyard in Sonoma County, California, initially studied the effects of climate change on the California wine industry and, by extension, her family's vineyard. But today she's an associate professor of sustainability science at Lund University in Sweden. She's an active researcher on sustainability issues. Her research has been featured in the New York Times, the Washington Post, the Atlantic, the USA Today, and more. In her latest book, Under the Sky We Make, How to Be Human in a Warming World, she reports that around 90% of the planet's total and finite carbon budget has been depleted. In the past couple of decades, humankind has been using more carbon than ever. She approaches the urgent problem of the carbon footprint, arguing that in order to reduce our carbon emissions, save ourselves from major climate change, we must create radical shifts in our daily life. And in the book, she outlines some of the choices we can all make to reduce warming in the next 50 years. She's my guest today on Studio Tulsa. Dr. Kimberly Nicholas, welcome to Studio Tulsa. Thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you, Rich. Nice to be here.
Your book states, Under the Sky We Make, that where the world is in terms of climate pollution and warming, you sort of state where we are, and that while major changes are needed in our large systems to arrest the rate of warming, individual changes can also make a big difference. How much of a difference can an individual changes on a large scale make?
Well, individuals are absolutely critical. And I think we are collectively as citizens and as individuals, we are really determining the future of life on Earth. So I think what I see a really important need for is translating the science and the kind of high-level political decisions like the Paris Agreement, which I was lucky enough to be in the room when it was adopted. We have these frameworks, we have the knowledge we need, but it's not really reaching the people who need it, and it's not really getting translated into something that feels urgent and actionable and connected with our daily lives. So that's really what I'm trying to do.
And really, this book is really... I think there's been a lot of information out there that really individual changes don't make a lot of difference in the whole. I think there's been a spate of articles in which you've seen that individual changes, okay, they make you feel good, but they don't do a whole lot in the whole range of overall carbon pollution.
Well, what I focus on is what research shows makes a big difference. And there we know that especially a small group, it's about 10% of people globally who emit about half of household climate pollution. And we are the group, I include myself there, who do need to make individual changes alongside what everybody needs to be doing, pushing for systems of culture and politics and power, businesses and governments to make the structural changes. So it's really a both-and situation for high emitters or over-consumers. We do need to make behavior changes, but for everybody, we also need to have a society that works for everyone without destroying the climate.
When you say that 10% of world population, is that pretty much the population of Europe and the United States and maybe a couple of other countries as well?
Yes, that's pretty close. So what the data say is that people globally who earn about $38,000 a year or more are in that group of the biggest polluters. And unfortunately, emissions and climate pollution tend to be connected with income. So the higher income tends to lead to or be connected to. And right now, we basically take income and turn it into climate pollution. And that's part of why we need individuals, because we need to make cultural changes where we aren't valuing and holding up as examples and role models people who are over-consuming.
As I mentioned, there's been a number of articles in the last 5 years or so talking about, you know, how much of a difference recycling makes, how much of a difference that individual changes in an individual household make. And it has downplayed that. How much has that changed the mindset of, about making the necessary changes and the big changes that you're talking about to really make a dent in carbon emissions?
Well, I was part of a study in 2017 that was led by Seth Wines, who was originally a high school science teacher. And we did this study because Seth got asked all the time by his students, what can I do as an individual? What are the choices I make that really make a big difference for the climate? So we wanted a research-based answer to that question. And what we found from compiling all the sources that were available and has since been further confirmed by subsequent studies, there are really three high-impact climate actions that do make a big difference for high-emitting individuals to quickly reduce our climate pollution. And those are to go car, flight, and meat-free. So those are the areas where if we can completely eliminate those, or if we can reduce and work on reducing the need for and the use of planes, cars, and meat consumption, that does make a big difference. And that's where we should be focusing our personal energies.
Hmm. Those are big changes in, say, the middle of the West here in the United States. I'd imagine it's a big change in a lot of places in Europe, too, where you live.
They are big changes, and it just kind of shows how far we are from where we need to be right now. So there was a study in Europe recently showing that at the moment it's only 5% of the population in Europe that's living within what we need to be at by 2030 to have a stable climate. So most of us are really over our carbon budget right now.
Well, the first part of the book, Under the Sky We Make, looks at where we are. And you write that about what you call the carbon budget. What do you mean by the carbon budget? How much is the carbon budget? And how close are we to overtopping that budget?
The carbon budget is how much carbon from fossil fuels and from land use change like deforestation, how much can humanity emit to the atmosphere and still succeed in limiting warming to 1.5 to 2 degrees, the goal of the Paris Agreement. And the bad news is that there's very little carbon budget remaining. For 1.5 degrees, which is really important for people in nature to stabilize the climate at that level, we are something like at least 90% of the way used up. So there's very little time left and very little budget left, and that's why it's so urgent. Right now, I dedicate my book to 2030, and I say, I hope we did right by you. And I'm trying to really focus our attention and energy on these near-term decisions. Just a couple of election cycles and really not that far away, this is a critical window where we have the opportunity to make the necessary changes, and we need to cut global climate pollution at least in half by 2030. Places like the U.S. and Europe that have been historically high-emitting, we should be aiming to cut even faster. But if we want to go back to something like, you know, we've already warmed the human activities from burning fossil fuels and land use change have already warmed the climate more than 1 degree Celsius. So if we want to undo that warming, we would actually need to take carbon out of the atmosphere. That's a big and a long-term prospect, and I think important to keep in mind, for that option to even exist and sort of make any sense, we have to very quickly get to zero emissions and be well on our way, at least if not more than halfway there by 2030. So I think that's really where we need to be putting our focus.
Now, a lot of people, I think, are putting a lot of bank in this. We'll figure out some new science that will help reduce the overall carbon level in the atmosphere. Is there any thought process of that actually being a reality that could happen in the next 10 to 15, 20 years?
Well, as a scientist, I can say that science is not going to save us from catastrophic climate change, in the sense that we're not going to come up with some magic silver bullet solution, and we just don't have any more time to wait. We have really all the science that we need to tackle the root cause of the climate crisis and actually get to solutions. And the most important and urgent is keeping fossil fuels in the ground and switching to clean energy. Thankfully, we have that technology available today, and it's been increasing quickly, but it's also not been replacing dirty fossil fuels. So we need to actually be stopping to build infrastructure and pipelines and things that rely on fossil fuels and be instead planning to shut those down to give workers a fair transition and instead switch over to clean energy sources.
Now, there are a number of imperatives in the book about consuming less fossil fuels, but what I don't see much on, other than the fact that we're talking about clean energy, are what means of energy that we replace the fossil fuels with. Because as you mentioned, what we're really doing right now is augmenting our energy sources with clean alternative, wind, solar, and the like. We're not really replacing. We probably are replacing coal consumption somewhat, but still, in many places in the United States and probably in Europe as well, we're still burning coal for electricity. We're still, using natural gas. We're still using heating oil in the Northeast and many other places. How do we begin moving away from the fossil fuels and using alternatives?
Yeah, that's a really important question. I think it starts with a mindset that we need to recognize, because of this carbon budget, because of the urgency and critical importance of stopping climate breakdown and stabilizing the climate, we just have to leave fossil fuels in the ground. And that's going to mean we need to get to actually zero emissions, where humans are not adding any carbon in particular to the atmosphere. And that has to get to the root cause of the problem. That's something I write about, this kind of shift in mindset, where I think to really address our intertwined problems that we face today, we need to center people and nature as the key priorities. It's really human well-being and the chance for everyone to have a good life and live on a planet that's thriving and that we can leave behind in good shape. That's really what it's all about. So to get there, we need to get to the root cause of issues, and it really doesn't make any sense to keep doing things that we know are dirty and dangerous and unsustainable and think about, promising to try to clean them up afterwards when clean solutions do exist today. And I think one good example is Spain, for example, has a Ministry of Ecological Transition. So there they're offering job retraining or early retirement and a fair deal for workers in industries that actually, like coal, do need to decline in order to stop climate breakdown in time. But making sure we're not leaving people behind, that everyone has a role to play and can be part of it, is a really important step to make it work politically and to be fair.
I know our own job transition efforts in our country have you're talking about making coal miners into IT techs or, learning coding or something like that. And, that's hasn't been very realistic. What is Spain doing that is realistic about their transition efforts?
Well, I think what does work is retraining in related industries. So not entirely shifting skill sets, but having, for example, retraining programs that go from coal to clean energy, installing clean energy sources. And there was a study done led by Charlie Wilson that showed that focusing on community energy, on sort of small-scale energy solutions like rooftop solar panels, for example, you need a lot of people to install those, and those are good and well-paying jobs. So those are the kind of solutions that I think can solve a bunch of problems at once. They can help with the climate problem, but they can also help with employment and social equity and other issues that we need to be thinking about as a whole system. So, we're taking people into account and making this transition with people and by people, and it's not something that happens to people.
My guest today is Dr. Kimberly Nicholas. She's a associate professor of sustainability science at Lund University in Sweden. She's a native of California, now living in Sweden, and her book is titled Under the Sky We Make, How to Be Human in a Warming World. And she's our guest today on Studio Tulsa. Well, in your book, you have several charts and mindsets. One is the five stages of climate acceptance. What are the five stages of climate acceptance, and where are we, in your view, most Americans and most Europeans?
Okay, so the five stages are ignorance, avoidance, doom, all the feels, and purpose. And it's not exactly a straight line, but it is a process. And I think the data say that most Americans, the majority, are either concerned or alarmed about climate change already. They know that it's happening, that humans are causing it, that it's bad, and they support policies and changes to address it. But then things start to get a little fuzzy. It's something they don't hear about much on the media. They don't talk about with friends and family. they don't see the connections in their daily lives and opportunities to help be part of that. So that's the gap I'm trying to close.
Yeah. So, you know, I would say we're probably somewhere between ignorance, avoidance, and doom, those three.
I mean, I developed a thinking of on a personal basis. I don't know if we can group a whole society, but I mean, I think the data do say we're beyond ignorance because, as I said, the majority are aware of it and know that it's happening. Avoidance maybe is still quite prevalent. And I know, and I just talked to a reader yesterday who said, yes, you know, this book is the first time I've actually really dared to face this because I turn off documentaries or I change the channel when there's news about it because I just can't deal with it. It's too scary and overwhelming. And I think it's that fear of doom that keeps a lot of people out of the game. And that's where I'm trying to offer kind of a lifeline through and say, look, there is so much that we can do. We have such an important role to play, both in supporting each other in this amazing and transformative and also difficult but potentially incredible and joyful time, and in finding our purpose and how we can be part of this huge, epic, amazing thing that humanity has a chance to do to actually, you know, affect the course of human history and life on Earth forever. It's a pretty incredible opportunity, and finding our way to contribute to that, I think, is just so important.
Now, your book and many other places have talked about the idea that the average person, say, in a European or American economy should be consuming no more than 2.5 tons of carbon pollution per year. What is that like? What is 2.5 tons? What is that? You know, what is that allowed? What do you have? Does a typical consumer have to give up to get to that level?
Well, there have been studies that look at that. The ones that come to mind right away are here in Sweden. There was one, another one in Finland. And the one in Finland was focused on what does it look like by 2030, which is, again, really important because we do need to make these changes quickly and happen now. And the good news is it is feasible, and it took a combination both of personal changes in terms of reducing overconsumption, so cutting out really high emitting activities like frequent flying, and also cultural and political and social changes that made systems of energy and transportation and food be much less polluting and on the way to zero emitting.
Hmm. Now, the three main changes that you relate in the book is becoming flight free. That means no more air travel, car free, and meat free. Now, flight free, a lot of us have been doing that in the last year due to the pandemic. I have a feeling that's going to change once everybody has vaccines in their arm, at least for a year. Can you talk about, you know, you're an academic. Academics travel all over the place, meeting with other academics, giving papers, giving talks. How have you managed to make that particular change in your life, being avoiding airlines?
That's the journey I've been on for a while. So basically, I'm a recovering frequent flyer. In 2010, I took 15 round-trip flights. So I was in this small group of people, it's about 1% globally, that cause about half of climate pollution from flying. Flying in general is not that common. Of course, during the last year, that there have been these exceptional circumstances. But even before the pandemic, actually the majority of Americans didn't take a flight in the last year before the pandemic. So we know that it is a small group of folks who are frequent flyers that cause most of the emissions from flying. So I was in that group, and I really needed a wake-up call, and that came in the form of a climate conference that I went to in 2012, where I had flown there and spent a long, depressing day with my good friend Charlie, hearing all the grim news and very dire predictions. But I started looking around and realizing, you know, I flew here. Most of my colleagues also flew here. It sort of felt like being at a meeting of doctors puffing on cigarettes and saying, how are we going to get our patients to quit smoking? It just didn't compute. So over a beer with Charlie after the session was over, we had a discussion. And he had taken a train there. He lived about the same distance from the conference as I did. And what he had decided was to stop flying within Europe and to make a bunch of choices to make his work and life less dependent on flying. I had a problem because I had gotten and taken a job across an ocean from my family. So I hadn't been able to fathom how I was going to address that. But then this possibility opened up from discussing with Charlie, okay, I could cut out flying within Europe. That's something I could do. And through that, making that one decision led to a bunch of other, it was actually really relieving. It was much less stressful to have made that decision and to say, okay, if I'm going to go somewhere, I'm not going to fly there in Europe, so I need to plan. It's going to take longer. I'm going to see friends along the way or do some hiking or check out a new city by train. And think about the trip in a different way, and therefore it has to offer a much higher value. Is it something I have to do, or can someone else do it? Can I do it digitally? So it opened up a lot of doors for me, and it meant that I've cut my flying more than 90%, and actually my frequent flyer gold card is now in a museum called Carbon Ruins, which is a museum from the future, looking back on all these crazy things we used to do when we were stuck in this mindset that was headed for climate disaster. So it's something that we can change, and I've seen how that can work.
Now, the second thing is car-free. Now, in Europe, I could see living in the city center, using the usually excellent mass transit that Europe has. In America, and certainly outside of the coast, mass transit is the transit of last resort in most cities. We're in the Middle West, the whole cities are, and certainly the rural communities are built on the car. How do you make that transition car-free, or I guess the alternative is electric transportation?
Well, I love what you said about public transit being the choice of last resort, because that is a policy decision, and that's a decision that can change. Right now, policies around the world are really incentivizing and encouraging car use, and we see that in subsidies, in the ways that cities are built, in planning and transportation, and that's something that we really have to wrestle with. And basically, the most important thing is to reduce the need for cars in the first place, to make it possible and desirable and easy for people to live without cars, to have what they need accessible without cars. And especially in city centers, that is really feasible. Paris is doing something called the 15-minute city, where the goal is that everything you need would be within a 15-minute bike ride or walking distance. And that's so much better both for our health, physical and mental health, for clean air in cities not having the pollution and traffic jams, and for the climate. One encouraging example comes from Copenhagen, which is known as a cycling paradise. But it wasn't always the case. In the 1960s, Copenhagen was a really car-centered city. And there were citizen campaigns that successfully took space in the city back from cars and gave it to people and bikes. And that is actually totally possible. So those are choices. Those are investments and policies and decisions that cities around the world can make. Even if they've currently are locked into a car culture, those changes are possible. For the cars where it is necessary, like you mentioned, rural communities, we do need to go fossil-free with cars and switch over to electric cars. But it's also really important to try and minimize the need for cars in the first place.
My guest today is Dr. Kimberly Nicholas. She's the author of Under the Sky We Make, How to Be Human in a Warming World. She's an associate professor of sustainability science at Lund University in Sweden. But she grew up in California, and I don't know if you consider yourself still American or you've switched to a European citizenship, but you know, if you've followed American politics, you know that infrastructure has been we've been talking about an infrastructure bill since, I think pretty much the beginning of the Obama administration, and we still don't have a major infrastructure bill. And the Biden administration is also talking infrastructure. How important is it for that infrastructure to have the basis of building mass transit in middle American cities that is not the transit of last resort, of having incentives for electric cars, for, just the whole infrastructure needed to reduce our reliance on fossil fuels? How critical is that in your view?
It's really critical that we make investments in infrastructure that are compatible with a safe climate, and we are definitely not doing that right now. At the moment, we have about 6.5% of global GDP is currently spent making fossil fuels cheaper and incentivizing their use. And we know that we have to leave fossil fuels in the ground, get to zero emissions quickly. So this really makes no sense. We're completely going in the wrong direction there. But we know that there's actually quite a broad coalition working to eliminate those subsidies to make sure that that doesn't harm the poor and vulnerable who, of course, need a right to electricity and energy, but that we supply those needs in a clean and safe way, which we know how to do. So the infrastructure is really critical. And another study led by Steve Davis's group showed that we actually have to shut down existing infrastructure early, ahead of its planned lifetime. So things like new coal-fired power plants, the climate just can't afford for those to live out their planned life. And we should not be, we're just digging ourselves in a deeper hole if we're spending any money investing on in pipelines and infrastructure that is dependent on and further locking in fossil fuels. We absolutely have to make those incentive changes.
I want to ask you, we've seen a small blip in carbon emissions during this last year because of the pandemic. What can we learn about the changes we had to make on account of the pandemic that could affect carbon consumption moving forward?
Well, we know from research, social science research shows that changes that are made during a major disruption are actually more likely to stick. So that is, of course, no one would want the disruption for the reason that we've had in the last year. But some of the changes like being able to avoid commuting, being able to hold digital meetings. Nobody wants to spend as much time on Zoom as we have been, but it is definitely possible to reduce and substitute some long-distance physical meeting with the technology that we already have. So that is good news. We also know, though, that incentives haven't fundamentally changed, and we have opportunities to make changes. For example, I just read a recent study that was looking at how to reduce people commuting by car to their place of work. And we know that's a really important source of climate pollution. And the study pointed out that basically having, in this case, the employer was providing parking for free. And that parking was actually worth thousands of dollars per year. So one change that they suggested would be to make the parking cost something. And it doesn't have to be that people pay, you know, you suddenly impose a tax. It would be equivalent monetarily if you instead gave people a $2,000 bonus each year, if that's what it costs for parking, and said, okay, here's this money. You can spend it how you want. If you want to park, it costs this much. Or you can take advantage of these other opportunities like carpooling, like taking a bus to work, like actually plan to relocate people to be able to live closer to work so they don't need to commute so far. So there are a lot of creative solutions out there.
Well, Dr. Kimberly Nicholas, thanks very much for your time. Appreciate it.
Thank you for the conversation.
Kimberly Nicholas is an associate professor of sustainability science at Sweden's Lund University and the author of Under the Sky We Make, How to Be Human in a Warming World. It's published by Putnam. Well, that's Studio Tulsa for today. The views of our guests and commentators are their own and do not necessarily reflect the views of KWGS or its licensee, the University of Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. Thanks for listening.